Are you recording? And you are recording now, then. Right.
It's what's the date today? The 10th, isn't it? It's the 10th of August, 1999. I'm here in Honey Lane with Dennis Mansell at his home, and he's going to give us a little rundown on his recollections of the, his times. Well, how I've got here, how were you recruited? Other family members?
I was recruited in a local paper. There was an advert in the local paper, and I applied for it. At the time, I was working in London at the Northampton Polytechnic near Islington.
Yes.
And I got fed up with going up 679 trolley bus every day of the week.
Oh, because you were living at
My home is in Waltham Cross, yeah. And I saw this advert, and I applied for it, and I got accepted as an AEO at $295 a year. Which is exactly the same money I was getting at Northampton.
Yes.
But of course, I saved money by saving on meals for going, because I could cycle home during the lunchtime, and then bus fares.
Oh, yeah.
So I was much better off. Mm. And time wise, because I never used to get overtime. And someday I got time off in lieu, but that's another side. Now, I never got the benefit out of that.
Oh, yes.
I'd leave home about 11 o'clock to get. To there for lunchtime.
Oh yes.
So working at 2 o'clock. I know it sounds daft.
And you, actually, there was that strange little quirk where you missed your first day because it was a holiday.
Oh, that's right. We're going to start there.
You started on a Tuesday, so you didn't get your pay for the first day.
That's great. That was in October 4th, 1949.
Uh-huh.
I was 22 at the time. So anyway, I lived in Waltham Cross, so it was only a 10-minute cycle journey to get to Bowdermill Lane.
Mm-hmm.
I joined the electronics section under Bill Beaumont, who was the experimental officer in charge.
You did electronics during most of your time?
All the time.
Yeah.
Well, actually, we did change the name later on to instrumentation.
Oh, yes.
Because that's what it was. Because in those days, we used valves.
Yeah.
Oh, people, yes. That's not things you turn hand.
Yes.
But the amount that we used to use for the heaters... We've got a whole bank of calculators, etc. And there, Bill Bowman, there was James Ladd, who was another AEO, much older than I was. George Sewell, and he was an SSA. He'd been in the Navy.
Yeah, but I remember George before that. I was with him in the main lab, but that's going back to the wartime days. Yeah, so.
Pause. We also had several industrials, mainly ladies, for making tea and cleaning and so on. So we used to have a canteen, an industrial canteen near us.
Old
Hobbit Hall.
Yes.
And we used to have it over there, scones with big as plates. I needed them for tuppence. 200 pennies, that is. And being youngish, we could eat them. Anyway, the actual building we were in was 816 on North Side, and we were in Bay 5 West. These are old Cordite reading houses, and they had north lights. There was no sunlight ever got into the building. They're all north lights. So that's where they had north lights.
The sawtooth top.
That's right, yeah. Sawtooth top, that's right. And consequently, of course, we had to have electric light on all the time. I can't remember a day where we didn't have electric light on. Where are we now? Oh yes, I go through work was in age 16. There was a workshop for the Proustone, which I'll come back later. That's for liquid propellants. And Burst Coral was in charge of that. Next one was Bay East. Bay one is that strand burning. Bay two was glass blowers, which was a small section to begin with under ICP Smith. He was a chief experimental officer.
Yes, it was quite an elevated grade at the time.
Yeah. Couldn't the PSO with only Frank Cranfield. He was an SSA, I think, if he was lucky. Bay 2 was a lab, I'm sure it was shared by G.K. Adams in charge, with Jeff Stocks as his assistant.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing work on propellants again, and the other end was stores. And there's a cordite winding section. Well, not section, but the remains of the cordite winding was in Bay 4. with overhead shafts and so
forth. And I understand they were still winding.
They put a special wall up to prevent if it was an accident.
Do you know why they were making it? Wasn't for service use, was it?
I think it was for experimental use.
Yeah.
I don't think we ever made any for service use, did we?
No, not at that time.
Not in 49, no, I think, no. It was under Titch Lermit.
Oh, yeah.
And then Bay 5 was our section, and Bay 5 East was Hans Siebland, who was a German to come over with after the war.
Oh, yes. He had a couple of colleagues, didn't he?
Later? Yeah, Neuensig was one of them.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know the other one, I never did know the other one. But Neuensig was involved with the proof stand eventually. Oh, yeah. And Bert Skinner. Been there since about 1935, it was the industrial.
Yeah.
And then the labs, Bay 6, East and West, were labs for the heat transfer section onto Zealand.
Was the canteen still supplying full meals at this Hobbit canteen at the time? Had they got a kitchen?
Oh, but that was industrial only.
Oh, yeah.
Because they were allowed to keep their clothing on, clothing on in the industrial canteen,
mm-hmm.
And weren't allowed to go into the other canteens.
Oh yes.
Because they've been wasted time.
That would make it a clean building then, really, would it? Or did they wear overshoes?
No, they didn't wear overshoes. They could wear overshoes when they got back
into their
building, didn't they? But they could wear. They had all their. They could keep their.
Ordinary clothing on, yeah.
No, it's not ordinary clothing.
Sorry, I meant industrial clothing.
That stuff there. And that's the reason why we could go in and out, for that reason. And they used to sell cigarettes in there, singly, because you could smoke in Hobbit Hall.
Yes.
And we could actually smoke in our lab. Yeah. But you're never allowed to smoke anywhere outside.
No.
I used to smoke in those days. I saw the light in the end. Then we had the electronics section. Actually had two functions. Basically, it was supplying specialised equipment which you couldn't purchase,
mm-hmm.
and also servicing existing equipment that was already there. Obviously there. In 1950, establishment probably recruited quite a few new people from the universities, etc. And electronics increased by at least two. That's Dennis Arthur Eldridge, but he was known as Arthur in the section because I got there first.
Oh yes, yeah.
And Hastings Charles Maxim Batoya, known as Batoya. And there was
He was D.A. What was his? D.A. Eldridge, was it?
D.A.G. Eldridge.
D.A.G. Eldridge.
Dag,
yes.
I think it's George. But he would tell you if you got it down. There's Alan Short. I can't remember when he came back in to us, but yeah, he came back later on. There's other people. With the increased numbers we came into the section, Bay 5 wasn't big enough, and the Cornock winding was transferred back to South Side, and the electronics took over after it had been modified.
Didn't Von Smith have a group over there, was he? Because they used to come over to the canteen in Powder Mill Lane. I think Albert Batoya was with them. And
so was I, actually, at the time.
And there was a girl in there. What was her name? There, she used to come with them.
Oh, there's two or three, two girls. You're talking about age 10 now.
Sylvia de Sav. Remember the name?
Oh, yes, yeah. No, there was two others. There was Sheila. Can't remember.
Oh, because that was a proof stand in, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I was going to mention that later on, that's right. Where were we? There was, because of the increase of people, we had to move out. Mm-hmm. So some of us went into servicing. As I was the youngest AEO there, they put me in the service section, which I found that very good because it allowed me to go right through the establishment. I knew more about the establishment than anybody else in the lab, really, in that respect. This is an interesting point. Can you imagine this happening today? Our superintendent at the time was Mr. Wiseman, Len Wiseman, I think his name was.
Oh, yeah.
And I was still studying part-time in those days. And he allowed me to use his office and his drawing board after work.
Oh, yeah.
For me, that was unusual.
Yeah, oh, that certainly was, yes.
I can't imagine anyone.
His office, where was his office then?
You know where?
Not in that building, was it?
Oh, no, no.
No.
You know where the stores was? Well, you know where the,
oh, yes.
You know where the building, the oh, you know where the lecture theatre
oh,
is?
Yes.
So you go across the little bridge that was there,
mm-hmm.
and his office was on that right in the corner there.
The single story building, the line of them.
That's right,
there.
Yeah.
I think they were the old army stables or something at one time, weren't they? It's part
know.
Of the army parade ground, that corner.
No, there. Not that bit there, no. You had to go over the river to get to his house.
Oh, yes.
But it was an old place.
Yes,
And he was superintendent. And another person.
It was a small building opposite the main stores, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
What was his name? Was it Cameron? Wasn't he in there once? He was the stores officer once. The stores officer used to use it as well, I think.
No, the regional stores officer used to be in the main building.
Oh yes.
No, you're right. They were in that area,
mm.
and then they got transferred back to the main building when Miss Davidge came.
Oh yeah, Miss Davidge. Oh yeah.
A name to be recognised. anyway, you know,
yes.
It was a very busy time at that time when we were in 1950-51. There was a lot going on. There was Mr. Verscoyle, do you remember him?
Yes.
Verscoyle? Pat Verscoyle, yeah.
From Essendon.
Yes, right. Yes. The Squire journey. Of Essendon.
Yes.
Very nice. Gentleman of the First Order.
Yes.
A real gentleman of the First Order. And he was in charge of the proof stand,
mm-hmm.
which in those days was by the propellant. And then Ron Smith came along,
yes.
and he joined Verscoyle in that area. It was in H10.
Oh, yes.
That's what the building you were trying to referring to earlier on. And they did by propellant static firing in there,
mm-hmm.
which is quite interesting, actually, because you go in there, it's like captain organising the submarine.
Yes.
Because they're in this corridor. I used to go over there to service the equipment, and of course we stayed in there sometimes. And there's a concrete corridor with a couple of glass slits,
mm-hmm.
reinforced glass, to go to look into the machine, into the rocket being fired. And then the captain would say, maybe inverted commas, prepare the fire, you know.
Yes.
Open valve one. Got on with the very headphones and the throat mics.
Oh, yes,
so
for intercom.
The intercom, well, we couldn't hear it otherwise, you see. So he'd say, open valve one,
yes.
close valve two, and on so on like this, and then there's fire. And this automatically set the equipment, the recording equipment going as well.
Mm.
But the beautiful thing about it is, as this fires, you've got this standing wave
on the shock wave. You can see that.
You can see that, yeah. Incredible it was.
Oh, yes.
And that's where I used to be over there servicing the equipment.
Oh, yes.
And there was a firm called Sutton Instruments, which was very famous in its day.
That effect is often seen today when you see a newsreel. You see a plane taking off and they
that's
switch
right.
on the reheat.
Yeah.
And you see the tone.
Yeah, that's right. But of course, in my day, I never seen it before. 1950. And that was quite interesting there then. Then what they used to do was measure the thrust and pressure on these things. And there was this Sutton Instruments equipment. It's interesting they used a condenser, what they call a condenser gauge. And these were effectively two parallel discs inside a container, which had car thread on the bottom, so screwing in, you know, I think.
Yeah.
Whatever three would be in there, it wouldn't be 18 mil, would it?
Put the screw into the head.
Yeah, of where
it was like a condenser transducer or something.
Yeah, there was a transducer,
condenser,
yeah. And it had a 20 puff increment.
Oh, yeah.
And this was lined up with FM system, and it gave it linear output.
Oh, yes.
Which it amplified up and put in the cathode ray tube.
But it effectively varied the distance between the
plates. Yeah, that's right, it's a pressure. This one was fixed, and the bottom one. Moved up and down like that.
Under the pressure it would move.
And, but it was very, very limited to 20 puffs.
Oh, yeah.
Picofarads.
Yes.
10 to the minus 12.
Oh, yeah.
Quite, it was very small, but
yes.
Because that altered the frequency of the...
Oh, and you get
and you get your
output.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And
The simple ideas are usually the best.
it's quite a complicated system in the end.
But the frequency
modulation wasn't as well known as it is today.
Oh, yes.
It was nearly all amateur, AM, wasn't it?
Yes.
Anyway, we've got this signal amplified up, and it's placed on two cathode ray tubes, mm-hmm. one below the other, one above the other, and got a spot which moved downwards on one, and for thrust it went up.
So you've got both outputs.
Yeah. And this is a photographic paper around a drum.
Yeah.
And the drum is rotating before mm-hmm. the firing goes, and then when they fired, it allowed the beam to come onto the paper
yes.
at a specified distance, space.
Oh, yeah.
It was triggered, in other words. Mm-hmm. So then it started moving up and down, and you got this. The peak first, and like that.
Oh,
yeah. They can't see that, can they?
Yes.
Anyhow, this was taken out, developed and then fixed, and then tried opposite, and then sent to H10, where the computing section. They had a computing section in those days. It was interesting because they used an old Marchant calculator.
Yes, a mechanical thing, with
a hand on the side.
Oh, yes.
Electric one, sorry.
Oh,
there was an electric one as well. And the seven figure logs they used as well.
Oh.
Yeah. They were quite interesting. Sheila? Can't think of it. There's three of them there, actually. Yeah. I can't remember. Went out with one of them. I can't remember.
It might come to you, yeah.
That was Sylvia, I think. Yeah. She used to live in London, Sylvia, did. Are we recording?
Yes.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. Anyhow, that was where have we got to? Going back to the canteen. The industrial canteen was on Hoppet Island, but the other people had the canteen in Powderville Lane, and we had to cross the river to get to it. I either went by the bridge, but there happened to be a barge there with a flat top with a rope on it.
Oh,
and we used to go on this. And the first one who got on the boat started pulling.
You had this rope suspended above the river, you pulled yourself along.
It wasn't actually suspended on the river, it was just laying in the water. But it was anchored, both sides. So the first one got on it and started pulling away, and of course the last one.
had quite a jump for it.
Didn't often get wet, but it was quite interesting. It was obviously
a bit of a pin on the end,
because that means otherwise you'd have to go all the way down to the bridge.
That's like by the library and
over the top and back again, which is a long walk in those days for us.
Then over Flagstaff Bridge, then
that's right. Couldn't think of the name at the time. Can't remember everything, can we? I used to go to the canteen. I found I used to go to the canteen after a while because going home, you know, only a day after lunch, 10 minutes there, 10 minutes, you're exhausted, no point in doing yourself. I used to spend a shilling on it. Right, balls now. After being in the service section for 2 or 3 years, I went back into the development section, as it was called then, under Pretoria. In those days, of course, we had to make our own chassis, wind our own transformers.
Oh, yes, you made your chassis from sheet and all
that. Sheet, and box. You had a proper box.
Winding transformers as well.
Bill Bowman was very good at that.
Yeah.
I don't know why EO did it, but he knew how to design them very well. And later on, T and U.
For the transformer.
Transformer. They were changed over there. So the two pieces of C core. Did you ever see those?
Oh yes.
What
about the center section? How did they get the center of the E? Because there used to be an E and an I, didn't
they? That's right. Yeah. I didn't bother with that.
No.
But I can't remember exactly that. I think they just bolted to each
other. Oh, yes.
And went that way round.
Yeah.
Mm. So they went that. No.
Oh, yeah.
And they worked very efficiently.
Oh, through one half of the
section.
That's
right. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
of course you did one.
The coil was just on one side of the
yeah, and there was on both. The thing was, there were two of them, one on either side.
Oh, I see. I've got you.
Yes. Yeah. It came back to me. Oh, yeah. And so we had to back out, because with the voltage in those days we used to use was 300 volts and minus 150. And then you had, because we were using valves in those days, mm-hmm. And the heaters took 12 volts at 0.3 of an amp.
Yeah.
So that's about 3.6 watts.
These have been a 9-pin octal, basically. Not the big bottles with the...
Oh, no, but there were one, the rectifiers and that were usually the big ones.
Oh, yes.
They're 8-pin octal. Mm. And then they went on to 12AT7 or 12AU7. These were miniature double triodes.
Oh, yeah.
And then there was the other, I can't remember the name there. Yeah. But they varied. Originally they were that size, about 4 inches high.
And then they
came down to about 1.5 inches.
Oh, yes. Yes, I remember those.
Yeah. But they're still... Mm. But then, after a while, we found out that they were actually making, they standardised on chassis sizes of 19-inch chassis, a 19-inch frame, I got it right. Mm. What they did then was they standardised on a 19-inch rack, and the depth of the chassis or the front panel was fixed too, so they're all in units of 1 3/4 inches,
mm-hmm.
So you could have 1 3.5 inches. And so on and so forth, quite a large size. And we eventually bought those from a firm called Impos. I don't know whether they're still going or not. Probably Impos, not.
Yes, I've heard of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that was really hard work in those days, because you had to punch all the holes in for the bases.
Oh, yes. And
it was quite a technical job in many ways, yes. You see. And we did have a couple of industrial... Mm. Who were made up to tech grades. Bill Dean came in as a tech grade 3, and he was with us for a number of years. I can't think of the other one.
I've got a few other questions here, Dennis, that you might be able to fill in on. Did you meet your future husband or wife at the establishment?
Indirectly, yes. But James Ladd and I used to go old time dancing in the old time does in the town hall, and I met my wife there. Actually, I knew her, but when I was a young person, because her father, her grandfather, he lived in same road as I did in Cecil Road. From then on, we got together and actually married in 1952, October 4th. Again. October
so indirectly, you it was your working there.
But once again, it was October 4th.
Oh, yes.
In 1952.
Oh, that's a coincidence. That's because October 4th you started.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Do you remember any humorous episodes or such like?
Oh, yeah. There was always a lark at our place.
Laugh a minute, yes.
Yeah. I used to wear a trilby in those days and come in the lab with it.
This old photograph I got here shows you.
Yeah, with a trilby.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I'll see if I can get a copy of that for the records.
Yeah, that's Batoya.
Oh, yes. Yeah, working
on his moped bike. He had one of his bikes with an engine on the wheel.
Cycle master.
That's right. The hat. Well, I came in one day, obviously, well, I'm most days wearing this hat, and I went to look at it when I was going home. I couldn't find the thing. Anywhere, I looked around for it, and then they're all laughing away. They were all gazing up at the top. And in the building we had originally, it was a.
He was cut a bit of a dash with this hat, but they took some interest in it. Yeah.
And the moustache as well in those days, I think.
Yeah, it's a very rakish angle in the photograph.
That's right. And here, there was this shaft went across the road, across the room, and below it was a wooden platform which enabled them to go up and talk to the belts in the old days. Mm-hmm. On the drive, and there was a ladder up the side, and halfway along this gantry was my hat nailed underneath.
Oh, you could see it.
Oh, eventually I saw it. And I had to climb up and get it off, which would be easy, I tell you. Anyhow, there was a good laugh over there. Another occasion which we knew about, but we actually weren't involved in it. But there was Mr. Zeeblin lived or worked in the other section of us, mm-hmm. and they had two or three assistants. He wasn't particularly.
He was one of the scientists that came over from Germany.
That's right, yes. Yeah. Yeah. He was a bit Teutonic in many ways. And now they started to knock him down the bank. So they, this person found a dead fish in the in the river.
Yeah.
They fished it out. Oh, sorry. And nailed it under his desk.
Oh, yes.
And of course, it smelled a little bit.
Oh, well, it stayed there.
Everyone found. And he didn't like it, obviously.
It was quite easily detectable, this
The smell. Smell was very, very strong, because it actually was going off before
it was floating.
And it got so bad that Mr. Zeeblin decided he'd better get the building works department come over, and all the drains were taken out of one night.
Needless to say, they didn't find it. If they did, they'd have kept quiet.
Yeah. They didn't find it, and he never found it. No. I think there'd have been some rocket fire. The other thing too, which we used to enjoy, the because vast areas over north side and south side, we used to go on the train. We had a train.
There was a locomotive shed by you.
Yeah, that's right. And a battery charging shed.
Oh, yes.
It was right on the very end of H16, and the actual railway shed was on the other side. And we charged the batteries up. Big knife shells, 18 inches, 2 foot high.
Yes.
So, that's what size. And took the thing out. Mm-hmm. And this is all right, but of course the railway hadn't been used for donkey's years.
Oh, yes. Was it still extant from the engine shed around the establishment in 1950?
We went to Southside one day.
Oh, you went under the road.
We went under the road, you see. But the only stuff was it used to go off the rails a bit.
So didn't we all?
So we had to get out and lift it on the cable. That went on for some little time, but in the end we had to give it up. I don't know why.
Yes.
I think it was just one of those things, you know. Mm. And that was interesting. This is a stupid thing that did happen in the lab. One day, Batoya was working on a piece of equipment on the other side, and he called me over, and he got a squirted a wash bottle in my face, you see.
Oh, yeah.
So I said, well, I'll get my own back on him, you know. So I left it a couple of days, and when I went over, he's there, okay, so I picked up the bottle he'd left on the top, but a bird squeezed it.
Yeah.
And the only trouble is he changed it from water into carbon tet.
Oh,
God. And that was really nice. Fortunately, he didn't go in his eyes too much.
Yeah,
but it was just how stupid things are, jokes.
Accidents can happen.
Yeah. Well, I've been very...
Yeah, well, that's been very interesting, Dennis. You finally, how did things go? I left the establishment in 54, I retired. 84, I retired. And when did you retire? When did you retire?
In 1987.
Oh, yes.
On my 60th birthday.
Yeah, so the work carried on pretty steadily till then, and you...
Yes, well, in actual fact, rationalisation came in.
Yes.
Around about the time you left, I think, was the beginning time. And we actually got transferred to Royal Ordnance section and moved over to Southside.
Oh, yes.
In G440.
You had a workshop there, I remember.
Yeah, G440, with the service section as well, because by that time there was what? At least six in the lab and four in the service section.
Oh, yeah.
And four in the construction. We were very busy,
Yes, you had quite a big group there.
Yeah, it was a big group there.
And so, of course, you were then, everything to do with the north and south side was attended to on the south site. That was your only yes. workshop then, wasn't it?
That was our only workshop there, but we were allowed to do work on north site by if they drew up a contract.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you go over there and attend to it.
I didn't go over there very often, but it was there. And we were in the PR section, no, P2, oh, Dave Sims' section.
Yes.
Was that PR? Process Research, I can't remember. I think it was something like that. Anyway, we were there. In those days, it was director, Dr. Bellamy was our director, and he also became joint director of Westcott. Westcott, that's right. And in my opinion, that's when we started going down there, because we were the dog and they were the tail, and then eventually they got all moved over to there. The tail was wagging the dog thing. But the actual process of costing was so ridiculous. I mean, I'll give you a good example. I think we were the industrials were charged something like at £30 an hour, because all the overheads were included in that, you see.
Of course.
I think we were at £40 an hour. When the painters wanted to come in, of course they went out to tender, they came in much cheaper than what we did, obviously. But one of our painters had to go with them to keep an eye on what they were doing.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, it was ludicrous, yes. really. I mean, if they hadn't included all the overheads in it, our painters knew what they were doing, and you know, because they had to make sure they weren't smoky and things like that. Anyhow, sour grapes.
Well, Dennis, that's been very interesting and an extremely valuable record. And if you think of anything, other things, jot it down on a bit of paper, and I'll slip it in the file. But anyway, thank you very much, and I think at this stage we're closing.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.